Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and Hotep. Welcome to the Care to Read Room. You've got your Omi Inca 7 live coming to you straight from my studio. And I'd like to welcome each and every one of you and say Hafari Ghani to those new friends. And I'd like to say Hotep to those old friends. And thank you so very much for joining us on this evening of the Black History Month. And also, we are getting ready to go into the month of March, so we will be talking more about issues that pertain to women. That's right. We are getting to the end of the Black History Month, and we want to remind you that we are still in the month of February, and we are going to try to get every inch of our Black History Month in, and you should be doing the same thing. I'd like to wish each and every one of you a happy Black History Month. And make sure that you're reading about your culture and know that you have a culture and not just a heritage. And we'd like to thank you so very much. Today, we are talking about girls that are rising. Where are girls rising? And our topic has come from a topic that's being dealt with all over the nation, even in third world countries. And girls are rising in different capacities. And we've been talking about women who are advancing themselves in their careers. And one of the topics that we've been talking about is advancing yourself in the area of law. So we have invited several women in. We've talked to our college professor in law. And today we will be talking to a law student that is located in the state of Illinois. And her name, the guest that we have for today, her name is Ebony C. Smith. She's a law student. She comes from Loyola University, that's located in Chicago. Ebony graduated from high school in the top 10% of her class. She stands very tall as one of our athletes as well. She attended the University of Alabama, where she majored in English. While graduating with honors, she also received her Bachelor's of Arts degree in International Studies and minoring in Liberal Arts and Spanish. She later enrolled in the School of Law at Loyola University in Chicago, where she's currently at now, in the fall of 2011. Ebony has held such positions at Loyola University as various different positions in the university as the Black Law Student Associate Secretary. She also has been asked to represent the Loyola in the Vista International Commercial Arbitration Competition. And this is a competition she will probably tell in Vinya. And she'll tell you more about that competition and go into detail. I want to go out and say hello to our guests, and then we'll take a station identification for a slight house cleaning, and we'll come right back at you in the atmosphere. Let me go out and say hello to our guests. Hello, Ebony. How are you this evening?
I am great. How are you?
I'm just fine, and thank you so very much for joining us. We're glad that you're here.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome. And we're going to do a little house cleaning. You're going to hear a little bit of drumming again, and we're going to go out and take care of some house cleaning business, and we're going to come right back and meet you in the atmosphere. So stay put and don't leave, and lock that dial in. Please do that for me, Ebony. Would you please? And hold tight.
Okay, I will.
Okay. And ladies and gentlemen, our phone lines are 646-478-0270. And we will have our chat rooms open for those of you who would like to chat in our chat room. So hold tight. Stay tuned for Stage Night Identification, and we will meet you back in the atmosphere, if you don't mind, please. Join me in welcoming to our stage for the very first time, Mrs. Ebony C. Smith. Join me in welcoming her to our stage. We're talking about where are young girls rising and where are young women rising as well. We're talking about those LSAT tests. What was it like to take the LSAT test? And what type of preparation could a student possibly have in order to prepare for such a test as this? We're also talking about how to help women in their preparation for law school. What are some of the things that we can be doing? And how do you get the help you need for financial input? And are there scholarships? And also, being that it's a male-dominating profession, how do women fare in this profession? Are they treated equally? Do they have the same types of bureaucracy to cut through? And if so, how must they conduct themselves in order to operate in a male-predominant field? Now, these are questions that we're going to throw out in the audience, and you're free to call in. Our guest here is the resident expert, and we're going to consider Mrs. Smith one of our experts. And we're going to call her right in. Will you please come in, Mrs. Ebony Smith, and help us as we discuss the topic of where are young girls rising? How are you this evening once again, Ebony? You have the atmosphere.
I'm doing fine. How are you this evening?
Oh, just fine. Could you tell the listening audience a little bit about who you are, how you became the daughter of a family member who was interested in going into law, and what were some of the preparations and admirations that you had as a young person going into the field of law?
Well, I've always known that I wanted to be a lawyer, that I wanted to go to law school, ever since I was maybe 8 years old. And I really enjoy helping people, and I was just in love with the law. I was in love with the courtroom, and I was in love with the fact that I could use, you know, my abilities to really help someone else. So I think that's really how I kind of fell into it. And I guess along the way, I guess to really prepare myself, I really spent a lot of my time really focusing on my studies and making sure that I could really excel in the areas that would allow me to be successful not only in school and law school, but hopefully to be successful in the profession as well.
Now, what was your preparation like? Tell the listening audience, what were some of the things that you had to prepare yourself for upon taking the LSAT, and was there funds available for you readily for your schooling? Did you have to go out and take out loans, or were there funds available for you during the time you first started to enroll?
So I guess to answer your first question, for preparation for the LSAT, I honestly just took a book and I really started studying on my own, just kind of reading through the material and taking tests under time conditions. It's really important that when you do start preparing for the LSAT that you take the test under time conditions, because the key to the test necessarily everyone can pass the test. But it's the time conditions where you have to really think within a split second what the right answer is. That's really the crux of the exam. So I kind of did a lot of self-preparation, and then I was actually gifted with the opportunity to take a LSAT preparation course, which was through a community outreach program at one of the firms where I'm from in Alabama. So that was really, really a godsend and a blessing to be able to take that course, because they are very expensive. When I got ready to go to law school, there are a lot of scholarships and a lot of information out there. So I've been blessed where I've been able to get some scholarship money, but I've also had to take out student loans. I think the vast majority of law students at this particular point do end up having to take out some type of student loan in order to really pay for your education, because school is very expensive. However, I have found my experience in law school to be completely rewarding. The people and the relationships that I've made have been invaluable to me, as well as the skills that I've learned and the experiences that I've had. I wouldn't change anything about these last 2 years that I've been in law school at all.
Now, Ebony, I understand that you're currently involved with preparation for other high school students in the Law Academy, and that program does prepare young students where you get a chance to go out into the community and actually use some of your experience in the area of teaching street law. Are you currently teaching street law now?
Yes, I am currently teaching street law now. I'm teaching at an elementary school here in the city. I'm teaching fifth graders. Now, I'm really enjoying that experience as well, because the students, they're learning so quickly and they're really absorbing the material, and they really have an interest in the legal field. And I think that that's what's most important, is to really put the information out there, because a lot of times students won't know, you know, that, hey, I could be a lawyer, hey, I could be a doctor, maybe I could be an engineer. The fact that I'm, you know, going into the school and I also have a partner, we team teach, I really have begun to see a change in the students when they're really excited to really talk about these legal subjects, and they're throwing out these legal terms, talking about different situations that they see on TV, who will be a plaintiff and who will be a defendant. So I really have valued this experience as well, in order to really influence these younger kids to really take an interest in the law, and to kind of demystify law school and let them know that if it's something that they want to do, they can do it 100%. They just have to be willing to put in the hard work and dedication to be successful.
And if they can, and they see that it's achievable, then it's doable. And I would imagine that some of those situations where they're learning about the prima facie case and bringing in the expert witnesses, these are things that young people in college don't realize, that the trial law would allow you to be able to do all these things and when you talk to young people and tell them, you know, you could represent yourself in pro se, and these are some things you can do to represent yourself, they're very, very surprised. And I've been talking to the audience quite a bit about if you can't afford the law, then go and research the law, and then at least fight for yourself and go out and use the law to defend yourself, because it's only, you know, only person who are ignorant of the law are the ones that end up finding out, I could have represented myself and I could have gotten proper information. How do you feel about teaching them about case law and some of the famous cases? And what are some of those famous Black American cases that you have been able to cite them to talk about, so that when they think about Thurgood Marshall, they knew that he trailblazed the area of law for African Americans?
Well, in my class, we've kind of really narrowed down the scope of what we're talking about, because they are very young, and we're actually teaching them about the civil law process. So at the end of our time teaching them, these students will actually participate in a real trial. They will have real evidence. There will be a judge, and they will be in the courtroom. So we're really kind of teaching the students, you know, like where you can be, where you can go. And right now it's just the students are so excited about it. They really, you know, they're students that really want to be judges, students that really want to be defense attorneys, not plaintiff attorneys, which is really surprising. But there are students that have adamantly said, no, I want to be a defense attorney because I see that this wasn't necessarily right in this case, and I know that I could sell this story. So it's a little bit different because we do have a structured plan because we're taking them through this mock trial. So we haven't really had the opportunity to really delve into a lot of these historical cases, these landmark cases, and to really talk about a lot of people that have really impacted the legal field in general, like Thurgood Marshall and Shirley Chisholm and many other great African-American historical figures. But I do hope that at some point we will have a little opportunity to really kind of delve into some of those topics with the students towards the end of the program.
Now, let me say this to you, Ebony, and I'm sure that you'll have a position on this because, as we know, for many, many years, women had to fight their way into a lot of professions, and law being one of them, because it was conceived as being a male-dominant field for many, many years, even for Caucasian women as well. So as being a paralegal, I go way back to like 1988 when I got my paralegal license and found that it was very, very difficult in a male-dominant profession where I had resided in a position working at Motorola. I was the only female woman there, and the rest of the men, they were men. And I found that there was limited things I could do. I mean, I was limited quite a bit because I was a woman, and I found that, you know, a number of men automatically assume that this is a male-dominant field, and you will stay in your place until we allow you to be able to advance to certain areas. I found that for a long time, women were not given as many difficult things to do in the way of research. And I said, hopefully these things will change. Even in some of the concentrated areas, I saw more women that were not in a lot of the litigation areas. They were more into the areas where they did less trial law. So let me ask a question. I know that a lot of African-Americans who go in the courtroom, sometimes they never see a trial. All they see is that you have been given an opportunity to plea bargain and make a decision based on whether or not you're guilty. And a lot of them might say, oh, no, I am innocent. But when they accept this plea bargain, they must, you know, indicate that they're guilty. And there's so much law not practiced these days where you don't see trial law in the courtroom. You see, let's make a deal. What do you think about those defense attorneys who, when they go in, they determine that the DA wants to make a deal? So how do you get real justice?
I think that it depends on the situation. Sometimes these offers by the prosecution or the prosecuting attorney, a lot of times these deals are better than the alternative, which would be to actually go to trial, because for a lot of defendants, particularly in criminal cases, a lot of the people that are stopped are people that will not be able to afford, you know, like the really expensive court fees and the lawyer fees. And a lot of times for these, like, smaller offenses, it is better, sometimes it's really on a case-by-case situation for, you know, a defendant to take, you know, to take a plea bargain and to really be paroled out and maybe to go through, like, a program where they can get their records cleaned of this minor offense. I really think it's just, it's based, it's on a case-by-case basis. And I think that I'm still relatively young in the legal profession. I've only been in law school for 2 years. But I will say that a lot of times, a lot of these plea deals, you see them a lot of times in, like, very minor cases and misdemeanors. I'm not really too sure about what happens on the higher offense in regards to criminal cases. But I think that just like with any situation, there's two sides to this sword. You have some situations where taking a plea deal can really rob this person of justice. But in other situations, taking this plea deal would actually ensure that this person is treated justly because it is a very minor offense. So there is, you know, not a lot of evidence to really kind of to really convict this person of whatever crime they're accused of.
Now, do you feel that some of the plaintiffs could very well feel that, you know, this is a first time offense. If I take this plea bargain, will this really be on my record? And what has happened? I've seen with a lot of young people, I did a lot of volunteering and pro bono work for the NAACP for many, many years in the legal aid department, and I saw that a lot of the young people for the first time offense did take the plea bargain, and they also end up getting it on their record, and it's not something that actually falls off. So they become plagued with this blemish on their record, and they actually end up paying for it twice. So there's a number of paralegals who worked feverishly to talk about with those first-time offenders, why can't we have their records sealed so that they are not damaged by this. And so many times we work so hard to pull case law to show that with the first-time offenders, for these young people who might be in college and who are doing a better job, that when they get out to go to work, sometimes it affects them. So we've been working with legal aid and trying to offer more assistance in paralegal hours, because I found that the more paralegals that you get involved, the more service that they can offer, because law is getting to be so expensive, the average person cannot afford it. What is the hourly rate, or are you familiar with the hourly rate of someone who might be a first-year law student coming out? And also, do you do or do you plan to be involved with working with pro bono law?
I'm honestly not. I'm not really sure what the going rate is for a first-year associate. I know it will definitely vary depending on where you're working. If you're working at a big firm or a small firm, if you're doing public interest, if you're working for the government. So there are a lot of different salary levels that you can get as a first-year law student, so I'm not really sure on that end. I will say that I do intend to be involved with public interest work after I become an attorney, after I pass the bar, because it's something that's really important to me, you know, to kind of give back to my community and to really inspire people, particularly young girls, to inspire them, to let them know that you, really the sky is the limit and you can really do anything that you set your mind to. So I definitely plan to be involved in some type of pro bono work.
I like your spirit on being straightforward with the young girl, telling the young girl that. Has there been any particular area that you're leading more into, and for any particular reason, your specialty? Looked at any areas that you wanted to specialize in?
Right now, I'm not really sure. There's so many things. Once you get to law school, that's the thing. You find out that really there are so many more opportunities and so many more areas that you could really use your law degree. Right now, I'm kind of leaning towards more international law, more like international commercial law. and maybe an international trade or something like that. However, at this point, I'm really open to a multitude of experiences and opportunities. I don't really want to limit myself by saying, oh, I definitely want to do this one thing, you know, for the rest of my life, because it just might not be in the plan for me. So at this point, I'm really kind of open to a lot of different areas of law.
Okay. Well, Ebony, I hope you don't mind, but we always do a ritual in this classroom, and we also acknowledge that this is African American History Month, so we do libation, and we do offer up praises to God and acknowledge God. So if you don't mind, we'll call out some of our heroes and sheroes, and if you have family members who've been deceased and have passed on and you want to acknowledge their names, then you're welcome to do so with your heroes and so I will go ahead and pour our libation, and we will acknowledge our ritual that we do. We'd like to take this time, ladies and gentlemen, to do our libation. We acknowledge God and our higher self and acknowledge that God is the highest one who we acknowledge. And we also pour libation to God and acknowledge Oludulumare. We know he has have a name, and we say Oludulumare Ashe. We also say Ashe to my mother spirit, and I say Ashe. And I also like to say Ashe to my father spirit, Ashe. I like to call on Sheikh Esdiyat, who also brought us great books throughout history, and I say Ashe. I call on Nina Simone, one of the fierce ones who was a hero and Shiro, I say Ashe. Madam C.J. Walker, who walked that walk. Not only walking that walk, he talked that talk. Surgeon of Truth, who brought us the truth serum and had us to speak truth over a situation. I like to call on Dr. Martin Luther King and his sweet wife, Coretta King. I say Ashe. I like to call on the name of the Honorable Marcus Garvey, and I say Ashe. And I'd like to also say the Honorable Elijah Muhammad Ashe. And if there are any names you'd like to call at this time, Ebony, you're welcome to do so.
Okay. I would like to call my grandmother's name, Lily Hudson, my paternal grandmother, Maddie Smith, my paternal grandfather, Henry Smith, my maternal grandfather, Robert Hudson, and all of my relatives and anyone else that has assisted me thus far in my life, family, friends, loved ones, everybody.
And those who you might not know and who might still yet be in the Middle Passage, and we say Ashe. Thank you so very much for helping me out right there, Ebony. I really do appreciate it. Now, Ebony, we know that Chicago is probably one of the most prominent schools. Loyola is one, and we know that there are great opportunities in the Midwest for law. Even though you've also talked a little bit about how expensive law school is, there's a change that's happening in the law school arena, and that is the marketing of the programs and having to look at the cost that is so costly for students. There is a change taking place in institutions where they are looking at their fees and their expenses so that they can offer a more opportunity for people to enroll in college. And I know currently that some of those universities, they're dancing to the tune of like $150,000 for law school. And most students who are getting out now, they're finding that the field is oversaturated, and they're having to look for jobs that they can't justify that are in that category of $150,000. So let me ask you this. How do you feel about working in those legal aid capacities where you are working in a micro setting and low-income area? How do you feel about working in those capacities so that you can give something back to your community?
I don't have a problem working in those communities at all because those are the people that need it the most. The people that are very wealthy and well-off, most of the time they already have lawyers, or they have lawyers that their families have used for years. But it's like the people that are like lower income that don't really have access to it or don't even know that when they even need an attorney, those are the people that really need help. And I have no problem working in those areas. I know that a lot of schools have recently started a lot of loan forgiveness programs for students who actually do take the time to get into these communities where, with lower income people or new immigrants to the country, like these people that really need assistance, legal assistance. So I know a lot of schools do offer programs like those to really help and incentivize students to get involved in those areas.
Now, you had mentioned that you were coaching some young people and you talked to them about their opportunities to be a judge. Now, what is involved, Ebony, with the process of becoming a judge? And is that something that they could visibly see happening in their lifetime, or is that a category that has been reserved for the elite?
I don't think so, because most of the time in this country, judges are elected anyway. A lot of our judges are elected. So if this person, if these students or if anyone wants to be a judge, you know, get your law degree, which actually really isn't even necessary, honestly. But I personally feel that it's better if a judge is an attorney because they do have some background knowledge. I think it's rare that a non-attorney is a judge, but I do think that there are cases out there where just like people that have high esteem or respect in their community are judges. But it's completely possible. There are a lot of schools that you can go to that actually turn out a lot of judges. And honestly, I think it's totally possible. You just have to really be willing to kind of put in that extra work, get into law school, get good grades in law school, get a job working for the city or the state.
Can you say that some of the judges do not have to be lawyers in order to practice on the bench?
It depends. It really depends on the jurisdiction. I do know that there are some cases where elected judges do not have a law degree, but that's very, very extraordinarily rare.
Mm-hmm.
But the judges, a lot of the circuit judges or like the smaller court local judges are elected. Mm-hmm. And there have been cases where non-lawyers have actually won those elections and have served as a judge.
Now,
it's very, very rare.
Excuse me. Let's get into a little bit about your background. I know that you are extremely tall, and you remind me of Sojourner Truth, and you know one of her attributes was her height, and she was able to use her height to so many advantages. How is your height very important in a court of law, and how does that give you such certain amount of esteem, you think, where it will give you that privilege that you so badly need on a courtroom stand? Do you think that that's an attribute?
Not really. I don't really see my height as being, you know, like an attribute where it really benefit me one way or another, like in a courtroom. I'm very proud to be tall. Everyone in my family, but I don't think that it really, you know, will really give me an added benefit one way or the other when it comes to being a lawyer, because at the end of the day, you really just have to be able to really logically, like, think through your case and really make sure you have all of your bases covered. And the height really won't really factor into it if I'm not adequately prepared for my trial.
And you might be partly right and partly wrong, but because they did a lot of statistics and they showed that a person who had height and stature were usually considered as authoritarian on things, and they always tend to go to the tallest one in the room for instructions or direction. And I come from a family with very tall people, and my brothers have found that to be so true. They've been given all this adoration because of their height and simply because they figured they knew the process or knew what to do. So in a courtroom, sometimes it stands out. So we like to think we have a bit of an edge in that capacity. Now, let me ask you another thing. What about sports law and the fact that you've been an athlete? Let's talk a little bit about your athletic background, how it might play a part in your profession.
At this point, I haven't actually taken any sport law classes. I'm definitely not counting it out. So I don't know if that's an area that I really would get into. I do think that I do have athletic background, so it could be something that could happen to me in the future to really kind of get into sports or entertainment law. But I guess at this point I don't really know a whole lot about the area because I haven't really taken a lot of classes on it to really kind of know to be able to tell you exactly what that would entail me doing.
Okay. Now, I understand that you have a background, a minor in a language field as well. Now, how do you feel that your language would play a part in your international law?
I think it would definitely play a big part in my international law, specifically being American and being from the Western Hemisphere. There are a lot of Spanish-speaking countries. There's a market for people that can speak Spanish, not only here domestically but also abroad. So I do think that it will definitely help me out in the future, and I'm also in the process of maybe looking into picking up another foreign language at some point.
Now, what area would that language be in?
More likely, it will probably be French. Because that is the French is the international one of the international languages of diplomacy, so probably working internationally, I think that I will probably have more opportunities to use, you know, Spanish and French, because I think the most spoken languages are Mandarin, Chinese, English, French, and Spanish are the top four languages. I think Hindi is number five. So, and I think those are the world's major languages, I believe. So, I think that could help me out.
It's really a bit a shame that none of the African languages are introduced to any African American while they're in school yet, because I know that Wolof and Twi and Yoruba, those are all areas that are very, very prominent. And most of the Africans that are in third world countries who are in Germany, they speak 14, 15 languages, and they also speak German as well. And when I lived in Europe, I found that most of these particular Africans, they could easily pick up any language and diverse it very quickly. And it's unfortunate for us as African Americans, we don't tend to get introduced to our own African culture or our language. But I found that when I learned to speak Yoruba, I spoke French before I spoke Yoruba. And that was the only way I could pick Yoruba up, because it was an actual sung, though, like high and low tones. And it was very easy for me to pick up Yoruba because I knew a lot of the tonation in French. However, when I lived in Germany and had people from Paris that came there, a lot of them were Africans who were speaking Wolof. And I felt so bad that me as an African-American, I had no idea what our African culture's language were. And when I worked in the refugee camp, these Africans were more heavily concentrated in Germany, so I thought I was in the backyard of Little Africa. And they were in refugee camps. So you know refugee camps are fighting constantly for their rights and their laws. And I saw how the area of law could be very, very, very much represented in those areas where you had a large portion of refugees because they were trying to gain citizenship. So I became very interested in the area of dealing with law pertaining to citizenship and refugee, because some of those people, they lost citizenship. And I saw that as being very much in demand, also in Chicago, because there's 139 languages in Chicago schools alone where they're bringing in students from all over. So how might you be able to take your language now and possibly offer some assistance with your legal background? Do you perceive doing something with your language currently now before you graduate?
Right now I haven't really count out any potential experience at this point. I know I don't really have the opportunity right now with my course schedule to really delve into areas where I would specifically be able to use my Spanish language skills. But I think in the future, once my course load a little bit lighter, I definitely think that I could get more involved and really use my language skills more.
I see. Now, when you say your course load, let's talk a little bit about what is the generic course load for most college students, and how many classes are considered full-time for you, and what's it like in a journey of a student? Walk us through and talk about what's the course of your day like, and how much time must a student allot to make sure that they're a good candidate for law school?
So I guess for undergrad, there's really no particular number of courses or classes that you can really take that will really prepare you for law school. There are classes you can take that will kind of hone your skills and maybe pique your interest. But the most important thing really is to have good grades during your undergrad experience, because those grades will really weigh heavily upon your application for law school. If your GPA is very low, the chances of you getting into a law school go down with however low your GPA is. In regards to my schedule now, I've taken about 4 to 5 classes each semester.